Slow Burn Media and Bill Huffman present Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless. Hello and welcome to episode 65 of Who Killed? A show that provides a voice for the voiceless. I'm your host, Bill Huffman, and this is a Slow Burn Media production. I know that we've all been kept in our homes for the past few weeks, if not months, due to the coronavirus pandemic. And this week, we are going to change things up a little bit, and we're going to talk to Nick from True Crime Garage about a case that actually has some resolution. So instead of leaving you guys hanging on Who Killed, I thought we'd bring some answers to this week's episode. With everything that's going on in the world, I thought we should use some positivity. So join me as we discuss the most recent updates on the John Tony Muncy murder case from Columbus, Ohio. And anybody who's a fan of cold cases and the cold case units who obviously are very passionate about solving these cases, this is an example of a team that was never going to give up, and it should give anybody who has a cold case in their city a little bit of faith that these units are doing everything in their power to solve these cases. And as somebody who started with the Amy Mihaljevic case, I can only hope that we will see the same resolution one day in her case as well. So join me and Nick as we discuss the case of who killed Tony Muncy. Everything that's been going on with the world has been a little crazy, so I thought I'd do a little bit of a different episode this week. And one of my most favorite guests is joined me in the studio to discuss, I don't know, just a little conversation about true crime. And welcome back to the show for the millionth time, Nick from True Crime Garage.
Thanks joining so you in the studio with from a very long cable.
We are distancing ourselves socially. We are in two different locations. This is a 100% socially distanced approved episode.
Yeah, I'm coming to you live from the bunker.
And I'm coming to you live from the studio.
There you go. So how you been holding up?
I've been surviving. It's been, I still have to go to work because I am an essential worker at the moment. And so I still go in and write the news, but I only do that three nights a week. Other than that, my life's been pretty, I don't know, watched a lot of Netflix. Done a bunch of podcasts, obviously, and listened to a bunch of books on tape. Love, I don't know, just been really devouring, loving the Libby app, which is the local library app for us. I don't know if that's a national thing, but it's a good place to get free audiobooks. And it is one of the, like, if you just search true crime, I mean, there's 8 pages worth of books to dive into, and it's really it's interesting. And obviously I have a Audible subscription, and I've read
I love Audible.
Yeah, there's just,
I'm a longtime subscriber. I listen a lot when I'm driving, and not driving as much the past 6 or 7 weeks, so I'm a little down, a little behind on my audiobooks. I did fall into some true crime TV watching for a few days, got stuck on the Lake Erie murders, the series, not the one that you and I were a part of, but the series that took place after that.
You mean you didn't just keep rewatching ourselves?
watching you on the screen over and over again. No, but those cases are interesting because they're all kind of this region, you get a lot of Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, and you know me, Bill, I'm fascinated with Ohio crimes, and the closer the crime to me, the closer the story to me. For some reason, I'm always a little more fascinated by it, just because often it's taking place in a place that I've been to before. And if I can visualize things in the story, it makes it so much more interesting and easy to follow. And also kind of to try to play a little armchair detective and piece things together myself. And some of those episodes, they're featuring shows and cases that are solved, and some of them are still unsolved to this day. Speaking of podcasts, I did listen to your podcast when you had Mr. Jimmy Renner on your wonderful show and talking about his passion case. And I don't have the gentleman's, well, I shouldn't say gentleman. We don't know if he qualifies as such, but
Joseph Newton Chandler.
Yes. The guy that was living as Joseph Newton Chandler was he really Joseph Newton Chandler or living? He was living as Joseph Newton Chandler.
No, you know how this goes. 8 million cases that you look into. I'll have to look that up. Yeah, I believe that's what he was going by. But it was definitely a very interesting episode for sure. And I definitely feel like there were a lot of people that really were interested in it. I just can't believe that guy could. I mean, again, it was just such an old Robert Ivan Nichols. That's what his real name is.
Yeah, and such a fascinating case. And one, you and James have a good chemistry. So that was really cool to hear that play out. But what an interesting mystery where you have this guy. Why has he assumed this other identity? What else is he hiding? What is he running from? That's what I think is so intriguing about it, because the possibilities are kind of endless. And on True Crime Garage, we did an episode, I think it was about a year ago, and actually you had helped me with some of the audio for it, The Invisible Man.
Yes.
The a man who was...
So similar.
He was living under a stolen identity in Indiana, and then he just up and disappears one day from... He had married this woman, and he just leaves her a note, says, you know, here's $100, see you later. And he just disappears, vanishes, and then the police, law enforcement are left wondering, okay, who was he before he showed up to Indiana? Where did he go afterwards, and why? And what is he running from something? Has he killed somebody? Has he committed bank robberies? You know, who is this guy? And what's he going to do once he goes and assumes another identity? Now, he stole this identity from a child that died in being hit by a vehicle, I think. And Chandler, oddly enough,
same thing,
stole that identity from a child who died in a vehicle accident.
Yeah, the similarities.
That was the old school way of doing it.
It really was. Yeah. You just walk through a cemetery, you pick somebody out who was dead before they ever were given a social security number, and boom, you have a new identity.
Yep, you're looking for somebody that's the same race and the about the same age. And the younger they are, the less chance they actually had a social security number. So you can just take their identity, their name, and their general information and apply for one. And if you get it, because back then, I shouldn't say back then, I don't know how it is today, because I have obviously haven't applied for a social security number recently. But, you know, a lot of these guys would just mail in the information, and they would just mail you the social security number, and boom, you're bingo, bango, jingo, jango, you're ready to go.
I mean, I'm a nonfiction guy mostly, but I will pull a little bit of Shawshank out of there. Because that's exactly how he got his identity in the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, so while we are discussing, you know, that was one of James's passion cases. And your show's been doing great. I know you got some exciting guests coming up.
Oh, yes.
Who want to discuss some very intriguing cases. A lot of them unsolved, which is super interesting. And then to take that a step further, even the ones that are solved or seem to have a conclusion, there's still some mystery and controversy within a lot of those. So a lot of interesting stuff. Now, I want to point out something. I'm gonna be a little selfish here and take up some time on your show. You've been listening to True Crime Garage for a long time, so you might be aware of this, but we did a bonus episode a long time ago. We haven't done bonus episodes in a while.
And it's been a few years.
Yeah, part of that is just, one, we do so much content, and then two, we have our premium show that requires a subscription. It's pretty cheap, and it's of great value. It's our show Off the Record, but the reason why it's of great value is not only are you getting a bonus True Crime Garage show, but it's a huge catalog of other bonus shows on there as well, and that's on Stitcher Premium. So when we're pushing that, it felt a little weird to me to also get out there and push a bonus show. But we used to sell these bonus shows for, I think they were $1.99, and that they're still available if anybody wants to go back and find it. But we did one on a case that is one of my passion cases. And the victim's name was Anthony Muncy. He went by Tony Muncy.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's
so
a great episode.
I'll give you a little background. I think that bonus episode might be close to 2 hours long because it's one of those weird things where it is a big case. And it seemed that way at the time. It's a Central Ohio case. And part of the reason why it becomes so big in length is the suspects that you had at the time. There were, in the newspapers anyway, it was reported that two different serial killers were potential suspects, as well as this one dude who, his name is Hall. Can't think of his first name, and Timothy Hall. So Timothy Hall is some dude that was way off the rails, and he killed this other man, this man that was trying to help him. And Timothy Hall has some severe mental issues, but what's super troubling about that is that he's also a violent individual. You know, most people that have this mental, you know, have these struggles, have things that they're trying to work through, they're not violent individuals. This guy was violent to the point where he murdered a man that was trying to help him.
Mm.
So they lock him up. And while they're waiting to take him to trial for this murder of this man that was trying to help him, he's talking to somebody that's not there. The jail guards can see him talking to somebody that's not present. And the person that he's talking to, is they believed that he might have been talking to the ghost, or thought he was talking to the ghost of Tony Muncy, who was killed, and it was unsolved. So he's an interesting part of that story. That's what we find with some of these really fascinating cases, that there's all these other little stories within them along the way. Timothy Hall, I've actually got onto Block Parole. I've gone to block his parole and sign that petition several times because he's come up for parole twice that I can think of since signing those petitions, and he's not been let out, and I'm hoping that he never gets out, because I don't think that he can reason in the way that some of us can, and I think he'll continue to be a violent individual. Because just the things he was doing before he was locked up would terrify me if he were to get released. Two of the other serial killers, one was a guy named Wickline, who I've spoke to local police. This was a guy that people told me, local police told me, like, we would never bring him into a room outside of the bars without cuffs on him and having multiple officers in every room with him. The officers, the guys carrying a gun and badge, were scared of this guy. This is how big, mean, and nasty this dude was. He was like 6'4". And if you bring up a picture of him, the dude had just one of those ox looking necks, you know, and they mean as all get out. And they nicknamed him the Butcher because he chopped up a few people. And
has to put it bluntly.
Yeah, well, they put him to death. He's been executed here in Ohio. And then there was another guy, and I'm going to get his name wrong, Eiler. He was from Illinois. He was a serial killer, and he would drive. He'd go out on the road, and he'd pick up these teenage boys and kill them out in the middle of nowhere. He got busted because he put one of his victims in the dumpster at his apartment complex. So it was pretty easy to link it back to him. And he was one of these guys that he got picked up for just one or two killings. But while he's behind bars, they figured out, hey, he probably killed all these other people. And his story is so weird. I'll tell you, I need to get like a team of people together and piece together the full Eiler story, because it is so crazy and bizarre. It doesn't sound true. It might not be true. He may have made up a lot of this stuff. I don't know. And I don't want to get too far into it, because that's a rabbit hole for another time. But back to Tony Muncy. So the way this went down was on Sunday, October 16th, 1983, the mutilated body of a boy is discovered. This is when men were looking for deer. Okay. So these guys are just driving to the grocery store, to a convenience store, to pick up a few items for the day. While they're out driving, they live out in the sticks. So they're always thinking about, oh, I'll see if I can spot some deer along these roadways, right? They're paying very much attention to the sides of the roads as they're driving to the convenience store. One of these guys, he spots garbage bags that are lying near a wooded area on the side of a country road. He says that he thought that he saw like a elbow sticking out of one of these bags, a human elbow sticking out of one of these bags. So he tells his buddy, stop the truck. They get out. What they discover is what he thought he saw is exactly what he did see. So they call this would have been the sheriff's department, Delaware County Sheriff's Department. They call them in, and unfortunately what they find is the body of Tony Muncy. He was 15 at the time, and he's in some pieces in these different trash bags.
Yeah, that was one of the things, and not to interrupt you, that was the one thing that stood out so much to me when I listened to the episode, was that arm sticking out of the bag, and just how horrible that must have been for the people that had to find that. And for Tony, obviously.
Yeah, and I filed a request years ago and got the actual police report from when they pulled up, and when they, you know, they're responding to this call of, hey, we made this horrible discovery on the side of the road. The short of it is they cut off his arms, which is so bizarre. It's so strange, because often when a perpetrator, a killer, will dismember an individual, if they're not doing it just for the sheer pleasure of doing it, they're doing it to make the package smaller, to conceal it, to move it, to dump the body somewhere and make it easier on themselves. So it seems weird to me that they stopped after cutting off the arms. And from my understanding, from what the way that the newspapers reported this was, we're talking about dismemberment at the shoulders and then again at the elbows. So I don't know if the killer was interrupted and couldn't dismember the body more before moving it, or if they just gave up at some point. Because you watch any mob show, or you read any serial killers that are willing to go into descriptions and give you a full confession, dismembering a person is not easy work. It's not easy at all. So maybe this individual just gave up at some point. But obviously they're doing it for a purpose. You don't just take on that task without it being a necessity, or like I said, unless you're doing it for the sheer pleasure of it. So that's how an individual like Wickline gets linked to this possible murder. Maybe he's the guy that killed Tony Muncy, because What is he known as? He's known as the Butcher. His previous victims, he dismembered them. One of the victims he dismembered just for pure shock and pure effect. It was to send a message. He was involved in drugs. He moved drugs. He sold drugs. He was, this Wickline guy was every bit a career criminal. He broke into places. He robbed places. He stole things. He cheated everybody he knew. And he's like a one-man wrecking crew. He'd kill. He'd do whatever he wanted. He didn't care. And that's part of the reason why I think even guys in law enforcement were afraid of this dude. This is not only walking evil within Wickline, but it's also just a guy that was born to break the law. And what happened was one of the murders he got locked up for, or I should correct that, he was never technically convicted of it. It never went to trial, but it's considered a closed case because he already got locked up here in Ohio, was this drug dealer that he was a known associate of. He must have owed him money, or Wickline didn't like him for some reason, because what he did was he attacked the guy, killed him inside his home in his residence, and left the man's head on his nightstand, leaving the decapitated body in the bed next to the nightstand, just for sheer shock value, just probably to send a message out to anybody else that he may be working with that might wrong him. There's rumor of him even going down to Florida and offing a person or two down there as well. So he gets linked to it just by, you know, this is what I think is fascinating, because some of these old cases from like the 70s and 80s, they read like a fictional crime story, right? Oh, this guy who's been known to chop up people, he's a known murderer. Oh, he was out in just the general area as this victim who had the same similarities. Well, it must be him. So just that fact right there, it's a big leap, but that makes him one of their prime suspects at the time. They can't ever pin Tony Muncy's murder on him. And it seemed to me like a lot of people at the time, or at least the way that it read in the newspaper stories back in 83, 84, and 85, was that a lot of people were pretty convinced that Timothy Hall, the guy that was locked up, that was talking to somebody that wasn't there, was probably guilty of it. Partly because he was closer in age to our victim, to Tony Muncy, who was only 15 at the time. And Tony's family had some weird comments to the papers, and I believe it was Tony's father who says, yeah, there's a good chance that Timothy Hall and Tony Muncy knew one another. I looked and looked and looked all I could, Bill, and I tell you what, I could not find anybody else that would say that. I couldn't find any other reference that there was any possibility that these two knew each other. They lived different lives. They lived in different parts of Columbus. They were separated in age by about 10 years. It just didn't make any sense. Well, Eiler, the serial killer out of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So one little story, underlining story in his bigger story that's interesting is, I mentioned the term wrecking crew earlier. There's a book out there called The Wrecking Crew, and it's about the defense for Stephen Avery.
Mm.
And I can't think of the lady's name. Is it Zeller or Zellner?
Zellner.
Okay. So she actually represented Eiler. And whether you like Zellner or not, one thing I've always liked about her, and I thought this was fascinating, was Eiler was hinting to her that he had killed other people that he wasn't being tried for. So she convinces Eiler to write down the names or give a good description of these victims that he's not been tied to yet. And she does give that to the public and gives that to law enforcement. She's not one of these dirty, you know, defense attorneys that is like, yeah, I know the guy's guilty as hell, and I'm just going to represent him and try to get him back out on the streets.
I don't know who you're talking about.
Right. So she's got some integrity to her. So I like that. And that's weird that she's kind of been famous now for multiple other cases. And back then she was just somebody coming up in the world and doing good things. They could never tie Tony Muncy to Eiler as well. And I've seen the list that he came up with, and there's no reason to suspect that he would have been in the area, in the Columbus area at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that Tony went missing is so strange, because him and his family, the day that he is last seen, they're doing family pictures together. Back, you know, you hire a photographer to come into your home and take pictures of the whole family together. Immediately after the pictures, he tells his father, I think he bums a few bucks off of his father, and says that he's going to take the bus out to the west side to see his girlfriend. His girlfriend and the girlfriend's father both say later, after the fact, one, they were not expecting Tony. They had made no plans for him to come over to visit, and he never showed up. So police and friends of Tony immediately question this whole story of him asking for money from his father to take the bus.
Mm-hmm.
I have no reason to doubt that was the case. His friends thought that it was odd, because him being 15, he would have had some friends that were 16 and 17 that could drive at the time. They have later said after the fact, hey, we would have drove him out there. But Tony, the reason why his case was always one of my passion cases, and I actually considered doing it on your show, and you were kind enough to have me on, and I talked about Amy Hooper's case, another mm-hmm. Columbus case, which I actually think I'm very optimistic about Amy Hooper's case now more than ever, and I won't get into that here. But Tony Muncy's case,
well, the reason why... you can't leave me hanging on that. I just re-aired you.
Well, so... I think by the conclusion of this story, you will understand why I'm more optimistic about her case.
Okay.
Now more than ever.
Excellent.
So Tony Muncy, I was always passionate about his case because I identified with the victim. When I read about him and read about his life, it reminded me somewhat of myself in my teenage years. And so in a way, I felt extra bad that this guy didn't get to grow up to be an adult. He was a kid that was kind of in and out of trouble a little bit, but he didn't do anything real bad. He was just, you know, he was a kid that would stay out too late. He might skip school. He wasn't out being violent or robbing people or hurting anybody or anything like that. He was just kind of in and out of trouble. And we're talking about all kind of small time, very teenager type things.
From DNA testing to the Dixie Mafia, Crime Capsule brings you new stories of true crime in American history. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Join us for exclusive interviews with authors from Arcadia Publishing, writing the hottest books on the most chilling stories of our country's past. You can find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts or on evergreenpodcasts.com. Crime Capsule, history so interesting, it's criminal.
I actually think Tony would have grown up to be a great guy.
But he just seems like an all-American kid, like your normal teenager. I mean, 15 years old, 1983. I mean, geez, like you look at his picture, it just looks like anybody you would have been in school with.
So he goes out, says he's going to ride the bus to go see his girlfriend. He doesn't come home that night, but this doesn't set off any alarm bells, because he was known to kind of just run the streets, and it was not a big deal. He would often stay out with friends and then just crash at a friend's house. Now, there was some dynamics inside the household where dad was kind of strict about the rules and mom was more let the boys be boys kind of attitude. So there were many nights if he didn't come home that she was aware, but she didn't bring it up to her husband, because he'd get pissed and get upset that, hey, the kids aren't following the rules. So he doesn't come home that night, but it doesn't, you know, like I just said, it doesn't bother anybody. It doesn't set off any alarm bells. they never all had reported a friend
like
missing.
That too, you know.
What's
like,
that?
I think we all had a friend like that too, who I couldn't get away with doing something like that, but you knew a buddy that could be like, yeah, I'll sleep over tonight, and you know, yeah. Like it's just he could fly by the seat of his pants.
Yeah,
his parents.
There were.
Yeah, that's just.
Yeah, there were kids that either their parents just trusted them so much, or they just were very hands off, right? And just kind of let them be themselves and let them grow up and let them learn through trial and error.
Free range children.
Yeah. So the weird thing about Tony is even though he's 15, he's never reported missing. In fact, his parents don't know to have, you know, to be alarmed by anything until they're listening to the radio of a discovery of a teenage boy who was killed. They lived in Columbus proper, which mm-hmm. is in Franklin County. Now, north of Franklin County is Delaware County. And one thing that I said, and some people thought I was joking or being sarcastic, but it's the absolute truth because I saw it in multiple cases in the 70s and the 80s. Delaware County is not as populated as Franklin County. Columbus is a major city, and it's the center of Franklin County. Delaware County, even to this day, does not have nearly the population of Franklin County. And so back in the 70s and 80s, because the population was so small in Delaware County and it was all kind of country roads, I said in our Tony Muncy coverage that one thing that seemed to be a popular option and seemed to be a successful modus operandi was if you killed somebody in Columbus, if you could transport their body all the way up to Delaware and dump them on the side of a country road, you seem to get away with it. And that's what happened with Tony Muncy's case. And so they find him up in Delaware County. They ran their investigation pretty hardcore. It was weird, though, because Delaware County really wanted to work the case. They wouldn't hand it over to Columbus PD or to Franklin County Sheriff's Department, which at the time would have been better equipped to handle this type of case. Columbus PD really wanted it. This case, so much so that they were actually actively working it at the same time, but they were butting heads with the Delaware County Sheriff's Office. Delaware County, from my understanding, what I could find from the newspapers, they did work every resource that they could on the case, and they had limited resources compared to the others agencies that I mentioned. But from the persons interviewed, I spoke to some of the people that were interviewed in that case back when they were teenagers. They were interviewed as teenagers because that's Tony's circle, right? You got to look within that circle. They seem to think, based off of the questions and interviews that they sat in, that Delaware County really thought that this was some kind of drug, that drugs were involved, that drugs were the motivation for Tony's murder. Now, mind you, all of these kids, I say kids, but yet they're all about, 10, 15, 20 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
But kids at the time, 14 to about 19-year-olds, they all told me the only thing that anybody in the neighborhood was ever involved in was drinking some beers, maybe smoking a joint. And I'm talking to each one of them, I'm like, yeah, you don't kill a kid and cut off his arms because of some marijuana. It just doesn't ring true. It doesn't track. You can try it all day long. It doesn't make any damn sense.
No.
So that's where you circle back and you go, okay, well, maybe Timothy Hall was the guy. Anyway, the case goes nowhere. We covered it, and I was so glad that we covered it because Tony, what was so sad about his case, because it was the early 80s, and partly because his body was found up in Delaware County. There was very little story remaining of Tony and of his unsolved murder and of that case. It wasn't something that popped up in the newspapers. It was not something that was discussed in Columbus. And then I got on the internet. He had damn near zero digital footprint.
I just looked it up. There's only, I think, three articles that I could find about it. And
after that, everything would probably be True Crime Garage.
And they're from the Akron Beacon Journal. They're not even from the Columbus Dispatch, where you would think that would hail from. Now, I'll do another research, you know, I'll run it again on my newspapers.com thing. But yeah, that's just, I mean, did you find anything on newspapers.com?
Well, newspapers.com is great, is a great resource, and I love it. But as far as Central Ohio goes, there's
very few.
Newspapers.com relies on the publication signing up with them.
Exactly.
And not a lot of the Central Ohio publications have signed up on there. So you don't get, it's not a great resource for Columbus or Franklin County cases.
Is there one that, because I know there's other ones out there, like there's newspaperarchive.com. I mean, do any of those get Columbus papers? Because that is such a great tool for people that like to do the research on these cases.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing, what I did was, this was a couple years before we covered it. I got on these, I can't remember if it's the Columbus or Franklin County, I can't remember what it is, but it's basically a news index. And you can't view the actual articles, but it will tell you, it's like a catalog of the articles. So okay. I found that there were plenty at the time, articles in the Columbus papers, because of what the story was and because of it being an unsolved child murder, and really just something that terrified that neighborhood, that general neighborhood. It, you know, you had interviews in the papers with kids saying, yeah, I feel like I'm next. And they had all these little kind of urban legends that were created out of Tony's death within that neighborhood. You know,
it's horrifying.
Yeah, some kids saying, oh, I saw guys driving around in a black car, and oh, he was seen at the mall. Somebody picked him up at the mall, you know, and there's all these little kind of urban legends.
To give the listeners a little idea, how far away did you live from where this took place?
Well, I grew up probably 7-8 miles from where Tony grew up. But
wow, okay.
But keep in mind, he's significantly older than,
well, sure.
Than, you know, he would be, if he would be alive today, he'd be significantly older than me. I was a little baby back in 1983. But
yes.
So this was just a case that I stumbled upon in my mid-20s and really wanted to take a look into it because I thought it was such a fascinating case. And so yesterday, you know, I saw you got the record button going. I imagine you'll put this out at some point, but when I say yesterday, I mean April 29th. I'm trying to support some local businesses, right? During this time, I went and picked up a couple pizzas, doing the carry out with the mask and gloves on, and some guy like invited me to stand in line with him, and I mentally gave him the finger, and I said no, but all he really got was a no thank you, and I waited, you know, down the block. So anyway, I get this text from the captain, and I can't really see what it is because I won't. I saw that it buzzed when I was in my car, but I left my phone in my car because that's another thing I'm doing during this whole little quarantine thing. I'm not bringing my phone into places with me unnecessarily. You know, I'm just walking in real quick to pick up a couple pizzas. So I saw that the captain buzzed my phone. Yeah, that's a good tip. You can use that one at home, people. So I saw the captain text me, picked up the pizzas, drive home, and I'm able to look, you know, at his actual text once I get home. Once I, you know, sprayed myself down with the garden hose out front and scrubbed everything. So before the first bite of pizza, I click on his text. He sent me, this was breaking news, April 29th. Delaware County authorities solved 1983 cold case of 15-year-old boy's murder. Oh. They solved his case.
Shut up.
Isn't that crazy? So it has no relation to Amy Hooper's case, but when you hear something like this, you go, shit, anything's possible. 1983 was Tony Muncy's murder. Amy Hooper, well, you just had me on your show. What was it, 91?
Yeah, 92? 92.
So one that this should give everybody hope for any cold case out there, not just Amy's case, but they solved this thing. And apparently they started working the case. When I say they, I mean the cold case unit in Delaware County. The cold case unit started working this case again in 2010, years before True Crime Garage covered it. And they were silently working this case. And what's so interesting too, like I remember when I first started looking into Tony's case, getting onto Delaware County Sheriff's Office, their website, which will be much different today because I'm talking about getting onto their website like in 2012, 2013, looking up information on this case. And one thing I remember seeing on there was they had a cold case unit page, and it said how dedicated Delaware County was to solving cold cases and how it was a very high priority for Delaware County.
Wow.
This proves it. This proves it. This is a kid that wasn't even from Delaware County that just happened to be left there. This proves that it is a high priority in Delaware County. So they solved this case, and it turns out they used Parabon Nanolabs to do DNA genealogical database searches using DNA that was found on Tony's person. If I remember the case correctly, whoever killed him was cowardice enough to stab this young man in the back. And we know this because of holes that were found in the clothing and obviously wounds on the body. But it would be believed that the perpetrator, we've talked about this on your show and we talk about it on True Crime Garage all the time. Stabbing is so violent that it often injures the offender at the same time.
Yeah.
Often an offender will very badly cut their hands or fingers in the process of stabbing an individual. So very likely blood was left on Tony's shirt and on some of his clothing from the perpetrator, from the actual killer. And I think they did run into significant obstacles and troubles with this DNA. Sometimes it's mixed. Sometimes you got to be able to sort it out. I don't want to get too much into the science of it because
You went to school for computer, not for doctor.
Well, and like Elton John said, all the science I don't understand. But through the DNA research, it sounds like they felt like they had a break. This would have been in June of 2018, and it was about 18 months later that they narrowed it down to three brothers.
Crazy.
And they were able to determine that one of the three brothers is the guilty party. This was based off of some additional information. This guy did have a bit of a history, a criminal history, that is. Unfortunately, the killer, Tony's killer, is dead. He died in 2013. And he would have been 30 years old at the time of Tony's murder. His name is Daniel Allen Anderson, is the man that killed Tony Muncy. So as sad as the story is, as sad as the case is, it does make me happy that it's finally solved. I did a little chair dancing while I was eating my pizza and reading the article. I did go back to try to figure out what Daniel Anderson's criminal history is. He's got a lot of small charges against him in the Franklin County area. It looks like he at some point was a registered sex offender. My guess would be, knowing Tony's personality and attitude and lifestyle at the time when he was 15, he was probably picked up somewhere. It could have been the mall, like the urban legend says. It could have been a black vehicle, like the urban legend said. He was picked. My guess would be he was picked up by this Daniel Anderson under the idea of he had something to offer Tony, be it a ride somewhere, money for something, or drugs, you know, a joint or a couple beers or whatever. Like I said, Tony was just a regular teenager, probably would have taken somebody up on a couple beers or a joint or a ride to see his girlfriend.
You said a van.
Probably
right?
Turned sinister at some point.
And it was a van.
What's that?
It was a van. That's what was reported. A van.
I don't have that information.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, because I was just thinking of how many vans are. I'm thinking in the 80s and smoking weed and, you know.
Well, and that's
jump in my van. We'll have a couple beers and smoke a joint. And
that's the problem that with Tony's case for investigators was it wasn't an abduction like you see on TV where there's, you know, somebody screaming and somebody's grabbed and pulled into a van, a creepy van. No, it was, we don't know where he was when he encountered Daniel Anderson, and Daniel Anderson probably befriended Tony, like I said, and then it became sinister at some point where this adult wanted something that Tony does not want to provide or be a part of.
Yeah, I could see where you're going with that one.
Yeah, so I mean, it's wonderful. I'm so happy. I'm so, and I know that Tony's, I spoke to Tony's brother, his younger brother, briefly when we shortly after we covered the case. So I'm really glad to hear that he will get some of the answers that he deserves. You know, I don't think Tony's parents, I know his father has not been alive for some time, but it's nice to see a cold case, a Franklin County, Columbus area cold case finally solved after all these years. And another satisfying part of the story is to hear that Delaware County, who says cold cases are of a high priority here, well, they just proved that. They just proved that big time with putting a lot of time and effort into solving this old case.
And I think that does give you a lot of hope in other cold cases and other municipalities that do say we are making this a priority, and they do have the technology that they can use to solve these cases. And I'm so happy that it's nice to actually have an episode where we know actually who killed the person, because so many of the cases that we cover, it's, you know, there isn't an answer and there's a lot of speculation. And it really makes you wonder, God, what was this Timothy Hall, you know, all those things that circumstantially connected him to the case. Man, there's some weird stuff there. And I would really love to know if this Anderson character had shared any of this information with anybody. And if they did, if anybody could come forward, I don't know what they would, you know, what they would be. I don't know if they'd be considered an accessory or what, but that's just, you really threw me for a loop. I didn't even, did not know that was coming.
Well, I would like to point out a couple things. One, if you want the full extended version of the story of Tony's case and those three suspects that we talked about that turns out are not guilty, it was somebody that was totally off of the radar. And that's when you see these cases go cold, often that's a big part of why they may go cold, because the suspect was nowhere in the circle of friends or in his anywhere in Tony's world. It was probably just a chance encounter.
Yeah.
And if you want that full story, that is still available for download on iTunes. Anybody can find it. Just look up Tony Muncy, look up True Crime Garage, Tony Muncy. But also another thing to look up is, look, Wickline is dead. And he was a big, dangerous individual that would have gone on to kill again. When law enforcement, when men who are trained and women who are trained to apprehend and defend themselves and protect society are afraid of an individual, afraid to be in a room with a particular individual, you know how bad and how horrible the person is. Eiler is dead as well, the other guy. Timothy Hall is still alive. And if you do if you type into your old Google machine, block parole, blockparole.com, you can look up Timothy Hall. He has another parole hearing, which will be in June of 2021. I have signed the petition to block his parole at least twice that I can think of. This is a dangerous individual who has not been rehabilitated. If he was ever rehabilitated in the first place, I don't know, but I don't believe he would have been. Unfortunately, he is clearly somebody that suffers from a lot of issues that he does not have control over.
Yeah.
You know, Bill, your show, our show is a big proponent of pushing that this country does not do a great job or a good enough job of solving some of the mental health issues in this country. And I'd like to see that change. But Timothy Hall is a violent individual, and that doesn't come with those kind of illnesses. I don't even know what to call mental health things anymore. It's just, there doesn't seem to be a good word or a good terminology for it. It's not easily explained. But one thing that people should keep in mind is these individuals that have these issues, that are trying to work through them, the overwhelming majority of the time, they're not violent individuals. This guy is, and that makes him a danger to society. He cannot be back out. He comprehends enough of what he did, but during his interrogation, he tells the police officers, "I believe this is the first time that I killed." That's another reason why he becomes a suspect in Tony's case. "I believe this is the first time I killed, and I believe I really liked it. I believe it's something I'll do again. And guess what? I believe Timothy Hall. And that's why I get on block parole and sign that petition every time. 2021, June of that year, I do not want to see that guy walking down the streets of Columbus, Ohio."
No, get on the Google machine, like Nick said, and definitely voice your displeasure with parole. And he is definitely a menace to society, and people like that deserve to remain in prison. And again, even if you look up his current records, he has not been a model prisoner. He's not been rehabilitated, like you said. Not that we do great at rehabilitating anybody in prison, but he's even worse. So with his mental issues, I do hope that he stays where he is. And I can't believe that the Muncie case is solved. And it's somebody who wasn't even on the list. That's crazy. But I do highly recommend anybody who's listening to this to download and, you know, check out the True Crime Garage episode on it, because it is a very, very thorough dive into the case. And I have it. I've bought it. So
on the iTunes store, it's very affordable.
It's $1.99. It's
$1.99. I appreciate you having me on. I appreciate our little bunker cast that we did. And
it was awesome. Thank you so much.
Great to talk to you. And I wanted to celebrate this moment with somebody. So I was very thankful that you had me on. And
the captain's going to get jealous. So don't, you know, I don't know. He might be mad.
Oh, he'll be fine. The captain's been very busy, staying very busy with things, and we've been busy with True Crime Garage things. So a lot going on in the garage, even though we are in
love the new shirts too
mode. Oh, cool. Thank you for saying so. That is the captain is the designer of almost all of our shirts. So
no kidding. Okay.
That's a big kudos and a big shout out to him.
Excellent. Well, everybody buy your t-shirts from truecrimegarage.com. Obviously, subscribe if you have never subscribed to their show. I don't know who hasn't because of all your kabillion downloads. And, you know, again, thanks so much for joining me. It really is helpful and appreciated.
Thank you, Bill. Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you again to Nick from True Crime Garage for joining me once again in the studio. Of course, he was in Columbus while I was here in Cleveland, so we were socially distanced. As you guys know, I have been producing two shows. I produce My Passion Case as well as Who Killed. Currently, I am working on season 2 of My Passion Case. I have guests lined up such as Kelsey German of Delphi, Alyssa Turney of the Sarah Turney case, True Crime Files, Evidence Locker, and many, many more. And for the second year in a row, I will be representing Who Killed Aim Holovic and My Passion Case on Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2020 in Orlando. It is definitely something that every true crime fan should check out if they have the opportunity. The new dates are now October 30th through November 1st, and if you would like to save on your ticket, you can do so by using my promo code AMY2020.
And if you enjoy this podcast and my other shows, you can help support independent journalism by clicking on the donate button, either in the show notes or on the left-hand side of slowburnmedia.com, and that is slow minus the W. You can also contribute to the show via the Venmo app with my username at bill-huffman-3. I will also provide a link in the show notes. Every contribution does help and does keep these Slow Burn podcasts running. You can support the show another way by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Those 5 stars do help keep these important cases that I cover in the spotlight. And again, if you guys have any information regarding any of the cases that I've covered, you can always submit a tip anonymously to crimestoppers.com, or you can reach out to the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. And if you'd like to stay up to date on the cases that I have covered, as well as the new shows that I have coming down the pipeline, please follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. And you guys, thanks so much for listening. I know we live in a crazy day and age, and hopefully until next time, everybody stay healthy and be safe.
Ohio is a land of mystery, from missing shipwrecks and lost treasure beneath her surface to strange phenomena slicing through her skies, from myths that have evolved around historic events and people to the unsolved murders and disappearances that keep her communities wondering what happened. Find Ohio Mysteries on your favorite podcast app and let's explore the inexplicable. OhioMysteries.com.
I want to take a moment to tell you about my podcast, Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage. In 1984, a woman named Phyllis Cottle was abducted in broad daylight, tortured, and left to die in a burning car in Akron, Ohio. At the time, I was a rookie reporter covering this horrific story. Since then, I've reported every kind of crime imaginable. I've been able to leave most of them at work, but not this one. The one that buried itself under my skin and stayed put. Phyllis Cottle was a badass woman, and I want to tell you her story. A production of Evergreen Podcasts and signature title of the Killer Podcast Network, you can find Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage wherever you get your podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcast.com.